This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in what can only be described as a stunning victory, after 30 years, Puerto Rican political prisoner Carlos Alberto Torres was released from federal prison.
From Puerto Rico, we'll talk with Carlos Alberto Torres and his attorney for 30 years, Jan Suslin.
We'll hear about a lawsuit by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU over the administration's kill list.
Since when do you have to apply for a license for someone our country has designated for death? That's what this lawsuit is about.
The protests in Arizona have been heating up, and two legal observers were arrested there last week.
I tried to telephone Sunita after she was in Arizona. No answer. She was jailed, despite the fact she was wearing a green hat and was a legal observer.
Stay with us.
Last week, we received some sad news about a long-term political prisoner named Marilyn Buck. Heidi, can you tell us a bit about Marilyn Buck and what the sad news is?
The sad news is, Michael, that Marilyn Buck died last week, and it was just a little over 2 weeks since she had been released from prison because of her health. She had cancer. But Marilyn was a longtime activist, friend of many of ours in the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Right. She was serving an 80-year prison sentence for her participation in the 1979 prison break of Assata Shakur, in the 1981 Brinks robbery, and also the 1983 U.S. Senate bombing. She was a wonderful human being, wrote a lot, received the Pan American Center Prize for Poetry in 2001. She was a poet, had published books, was really committed to civil rights in every sense of the word.
So we've really lost an important political fighter who sadly only got to see a couple of weeks of freedom after many, many years in jail.
It was very sad. I used to correspond with Marilyn, and I was so looking forward to getting to be friendly with her and being with her in person and not just through the mails. I remember the CD release party that a number of her friends and supporters gave about 4 years ago when she came out with a CD of her poetry. And I wonder, Heidi, whether you could read one of her poems for our listeners.
Yes, I have a poem here called Rescue the Word that Marilyn wrote in 1992. Sacred words are in danger. Fugitives, they seek cover, bury themselves alive, shamed by the profane purposes they are forced to serve. Dressed in lily-white lies, words are in danger. English-only vows to tear out tongues. Exiled witnesses to collective memory and homeland ties. Sacred words are in danger. Trapped, they hang on billboards. Judas goats to conjure deception. Sing them, shout them, teach them, wear them around your neck. Amulets against amnesia. And that was published in her book, Rescue the Word, which came out in 2001.
Thank you, Heidi.
Jim Lafferty, welcome to Law and Disorder. So what's a freewheeling left-wing attorney from California doing in Albany at an NI War conference?
I was there as one of the organizers along with at least 775 participants in a surprisingly well-attended anti-war conference, the United National Peace Conference. Those of us that had organized this conference had no expectation or even hope that we would have close to 800 people participate. That makes it the largest gathering of anti-war forces in this country since Vietnam. All the major anti-war groups and some of the smaller groups were participating. Major union forces from around the country participated. Major union leaders played active roles in the conference.
So what's going to come from it, Jim? You know, I guess what came right away is you got Obama to pull most of the troops out, right? He says end combat in Iraq. Is that right?
Well, of course, I wish we could take credit for anything that happens that quickly, but the 50,000 troops that are going to remain, whatever he says about them, are going to be participating in combat. The situation in Iraq, of course, continues to deteriorate on a daily basis.
It's BS.
Well, of course, it's utter BS. I suppose it's not much better than the WAG during Vietnam who said when we were losing, why don't we just declare victory and go home, even though it's not true. And that's essentially what he's doing with Iraq. With Afghanistan, he's simply, of course, kept his one of his few campaign promises he's kept. He's escalated the war in Afghanistan to huge proportions. The death toll on both sides of the line there is going to get greater and greater, and already has. As the WikiLeaks documents show, those of us in the anti-war movement have been saying for some years now that this war is not only wrong morally, but unwinnable, and that we're tied up with all sorts of corrupt cross-political currents going on between Pakistan and Afghanistan, sadly have had that confirmed. The conference decided to do a number of things in answer to your question earlier. First of all, it's going to have united anti-war actions both this fall and next April. In addition to that, it did something else, which I thought was quite remarkable, and I think it was because we had so many labor leaders and persons of color present. We agreed to also sign on to some national calls for action around civil rights matters that the NAACP is doing and that the labor movement under the leadership of the UAW and SEIU and others are doing. And those will be joint demonstrations as well, where the anti-war demands will be part of those. Also, in recognition of the fact that the Muslim community in this country continues to more and more suffer discrimination on a daily basis, the efforts in New York and elsewhere around the country to stop the building of mosques, the targeting, the extrajudicial and targeting of Muslim activists. Many Muslim leadership was present at the anti-war conference. We passed a great many resolutions in recognition of what they're doing, and form strong bonds with them in terms of making sure that the anti-war protests that happened this fall and next spring are taken to account.
Jim, what struck me, and I think it's first, is that you actually identify the Palestinians as part of the peace movement and took positions on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that some wings of the anti-war movement, such as ANSWER, have been doing for some time. But this is the first time that a united gathering of all the forces took a very strong position on condemning the U.S. aid to Israel, condemning what's happened with the flotilla when the Israelis attacked the flotilla, the Gaza Freedom Boats, demanding an end to Israeli occupation of Palestine and so forth. Many Palestinian groups were represented, and overwhelmingly that passed, you see. And so that was also a good sign. And even a year ago, I think, that would have been a far more divisive issue than it was. But I think Israel's actions and the United States' actions in support of Israel over the last 6 months and certainly over the last many years has finally culminated in an understanding in the anti-war movement that what happens in the Middle East is it concerns Palestine as well, and what happens in Afghanistan and Iraq cannot be delinked from
it. It's all of a piece, absolutely. Jim, before we say goodbye, is there a website that our listeners can go to learn about participating in building these upcoming anti-war actions?
Oh, absolutely. And that building is beginning as we speak. They can go to UNAC. It's UNAC.org. You can also go to the National Assembly .org. Either that, UNAC, UNAC.org, or the National Assembly.org will get you all the various resolutions and the call to action that came out of that conference and let you know how your organization could plug into it and make it even bigger and broader than it was in Albany. Say, Heidi, I represented the National Lawyers Guild there, you know.
And, thank you.
People were thrilled to have us there in that capacity. And many, many people came up to me and congratulated the Lawyers Guild for being part of this and for all the good work that we do.
Thank
great
you, Jim.
Great work, Jim.
Last week, Puerto Rican community activist Carlos Alberto Torres was released from a federal prison in Peking, Illinois, after serving 30 years as a political prisoner. Torres was convicted of seditious conspiracy, conspiring to use force against the lawful authority of the United States over Puerto Rico. Torres was punished for being a member of an armed clandestine organization called the FALN, the Armed Forces of National Liberation, which had claimed responsibility for bombings in Chicago that resulted in no deaths. He wasn't accused of the bombings, only of being a member of the FALN. In 1898, Puerto Rico was ceded to the United States by Spain as war bounty in the treaty that ended the Spanish-American War, and has occupied it since. Torres was sentenced to 78 years in prison, but used international law in his defense. Torres argued that the courts of the colonizing country may not criminalize captured anti-colonial combatants, but must turn them over to an impartial international tribunal to have their status adjudicated.
There was an outpouring of support to free Carlos. His attorney, National Lawyers Guild member Jan Sussler of the Chicago People's Law Office, notes, "Carlos is being released from prison due to the unflagging support of the Puerto Rican independence movement and others who worked for human rights. The more than 10,000 letters of support from the U.S., Puerto Rico, Mexico, and other countries sent a strong message to the Parole Commission." We're joined today by Jan Sussler, and later with her client, Carlos Torres.
Welcome, Jan, to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you all from Puerto Rico.
Well, it's not often that we have cause for celebration on this program, and this certainly is just that, cause for major celebration. After 30 years, Carlos Alberto Torres was released from federal prison, and you have been his attorney. Can you give us a little summary of how this happened?
Oh, well, mostly how it happened was with the support of the people of the nation of Puerto Rico and people like you all who love human rights and justice and fight for it. He got an extraordinarily disproportionate sentence to punish him for who he was politically and who he is politically. And, of course, he and his compañeros were always treated to the worst that the Bureau of Prisons had to offer. He did 30 years standing tall and maintaining his political integrity and came out to a nation that has just embraced him so beautifully. It's just people stop him on the street. He can't walk down the street. People stop him to embrace him and thank him for his contribution to his country. It's just breathtakingly beautiful to witness.
Now, we want to remind listeners that Carlos was not actually accused of the bombings, but for rather being a member of the FALN.
Well, it's a real guilt by association thing. He was convicted of seditious conspiracy, of conspiring to use force against the lawful, quote-unquote, authority of the United States over Puerto Rico. And basically what happened was the FALN, the Armed Forces of National Liberation, took responsibility for several actions, including some buildings that were bombed, and said that it was in the name of independence for Puerto Rico. In the case he was accused of, the different actions that were involved in the seditious conspiracy involved no death and no injury to any human being. It was all property damage. He was convicted of being part of the organization that took the responsibility for those bombings. When the judge was instructing the jury, he told the jury, you don't have to decide that he did anything, just that he agreed to be part of the organization that took responsibility for it. Now, if he had actually killed or injured somebody, and just as a social prisoner, he would have gotten less of a sentence, and he would have served far less time. I mean, statistically, the amount of time that he was given and the amount of time he ended up serving was far greater than anyone who commits a violent crime.
And that's something that we've seen the U.S. government doing a lot, even recently, is going after individuals with political viewpoints because of their associations. We saw it
Absolutely.
With a group called the RNC 8 in Minneapolis. And so this is just testimony to what the movements, the people can do. How long have you been representing Carlos?
30 years.
Oh, the whole time.
Years. Amazing,
oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely remarkable. I mean, I know remarkable for having spent 30 years and coming out intact and able to deal with his life, but you're staying with him for 30 years is just really something.
Well, you know what? It's a delight. It really is a privilege. I feel like in the United States, we are sometimes deprived of contact with people from Latin America and the rest of the world who really understand what struggle is. And to be in contact with people like him and the other political prisoners, Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's still in prison after 29 years for the independence of Puerto Rico, it's such a privilege. It's a joy. And my life is blessed. Lolita Lebron passed away while right after Carlos got out, and she was one of the nationalists who opened fire in U.S. Congress in 1954 and served 25 years in U.S. prisons. And to the day she died, was revered by every Puerto Rican, no matter what their political beliefs were, as somebody who really stands tall for what she believes in and gained the respect of the entire country. So, you know, to be part of that is such a privilege.
Can you just give me a sense of what Carlos' life was like for the 30 years? He was moved to different prisons. What prisons was he in?
Yeah, he was transferred around in the federal prison system. He was always in medium security, which is not how all of them were treated. They picked and chose who they were going to really target. He was always treated more harshly than the other prisoners around him. When, for example, on 9/11, the U.S. rounded up political prisoners from every movement, including him, put them in the hole, knowing full well they had absolutely nothing to do with it, held them incommunicado for months. You know, you're always watched. You're always monitored. You're always regarded in a way that is far more imposing. Here's an example. They have imposed this new system of email in the federal prison system. Every prisoner has access to email. They didn't let him have access to email. And I'm talking about the year that he was getting out. He was so dangerous, they wouldn't give him access to email when every other federal prisoner has it. Yeah. So it's that kind of pressure that's on you constantly. And the purpose of it really is to try to make you renounce your beliefs and say, look, this is just too hard. I can't deal with this. I'll do anything you want so I can get out of here. And obviously it didn't work.
Jan, would you like to put Carlos on? Maybe he'd like to say a few words to the audience.
I would love for him to talk to you.
Great.
I'm going to put him on right this minute. Hello.
Carlos, it's Michael Ratner speaking.
Michael.
And Heidi Boghossian.
And Michael Smith. Carlos, congratulations. Heidi. You're one of our heroes. It's really a great privilege to have you on the air here on Law and Disorder.
Free in Puerto Rico, which is incredible.
Yes.
We wondered whether you'd like to say a few words. So our audience is nationwide, but particularly in the tri-state area.
Yes, I want to say hello to everybody and extend my thanks to all those people that supported the effort that resulted in my release. The support and the reception that I've gotten here at home in Puerto Rico has been no way to describe it. I never imagined it would be so loving and so fantastic and so supportive. If I imagined it one way, it's 100 times better than that. I'm very happy. The only cloud in this whole thing is that we still have two political prisoners in jail, two Puerto Rican political prisoners in jail, Carl Lopez and Avelino Gonzalez, and it just puts a damper on everything. I'm just so anxious to get involved and do everything that I can to support the effort to bring the brothers out. Oscar has been in jail 29 years, and that is an irrational thing that he would still be held 29 years. And Avelino Gonzalez is a man who's 72 years old and is sick and still has to serve several years. So as wonderful a time as I'm having and I am, I just can't get Oscar Lopez Rivera and Avelino Gonzalez out of my head. We need to do everything to get them out, and I'm going to do everything I can to support that effort. But other than that cloud that just hangs over us, the reception here has been fantastic.
When you came into Puerto Rico, you came in on an airplane, and were you greeted at the airport or in other ways or what?
We flew from Chicago, and I had family with me, and I had friends with us, supporters. It was just a great experience, and we landed in Puerto Rico, and we were met by a mob of friends and family, and I was mobbed and jostled and pushed, and I loved every second of it. If you look at the pictures, I'm smiling, and that's because I loved it, and it was an expression of sheer unadulterated love, and for that I'm very grateful and honored to have had such a great reception.
Years ago I was in Cuba, and I have a large poster of you in my office, and it is truly an honor to speak with you after the injustices that you've been through. This gives us some hope that maybe some more good will happen.
That's how I see this release. I feel absolutely hopeful, and I have a sense that it won't be as difficult to get Oscar out, but that's just me. Hopefully that's not just wishful thinking, but I don't underestimate the hard work and effort that it's going to take to get those compañeros out.
And where is Oscar incarcerated?
Oscar is incarcerated in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Not a good place.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you something. How did you actually get out? What was the technical way?
I was paroled by the U.S. Parole Commission and given conditions, and I accepted those conditions. The conditions are pretty much the common conditions that almost everybody today when he leaves prison has to agree to. So, but I'm actually on parole. I can solicit release from that parole earlier, but the compañeros who got out in 99, they served about 5 years on parole before their parole terminated.
Is it true that Oscar was offered and refused clemency under the Clinton administration?
Oscar had two sentences. He was offered a commutation for the first one, which was the serious sentence, but not offer a commutation on the second sentence. The second sentence would have allowed him to be released after about 8 years if the parole commission agreed to it. Yes, as far as I know, he turned it down, and I believe it's my understanding that he turned it down in part in solidarity with the fact that I wasn't offered the same commutation as the other compañeros.
Carlos, can you mention the names of the two people again, and our listeners can do to support the campaign to free them?
They are Oscar Lopez Rivera and Avelino Gonzalez Claudio. You can go on the boricuahumanrights.org. If you log into that, there's information there, what you can do, how you can support the effort to free these two Puerto Rican political prisoners.
We will link to that, and also the National Lawyers Guild, and I'm sure the Center for Constitutional Rights. I have a question. Have you used a cell phone yet, Carlos?
Not only have I used one, I own one now. Ah. Now I feel like I just feel so modern now, you know. I still don't know how to use most of the functions in it. I'm technologically behind, so it's going to take me a few weeks to learn all these things.
How old were you when you went into prison?
I was 27 years old. I'm 57 years old right now.
Jan mentioned, and we've already talked about it in this program a little bit, the death of Lolita Lebron. And I just wanted to know some of your feelings and thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, you can imagine how all independentistas feel. I mean, Lolita Lebron was, we don't have enough time to describe in words, what that woman demonstrated and gave as an example throughout her whole life to us. You know, she did, her demonstration was in her, not only in her words, but in her actions. I heard a lot of phrases during all the activities surrounding her burial and her wake and burial. I was picking up, just listening to people's comments, and one of them that was very common was, you know, a lot of people referred to as la madre de la patria, the mother of our homeland. So that tells you these are spontaneous remarks that people are making. My God, I mean, in those few words, you can pretty much sum it up. What love we had for Lolita, what respect, what admiration. She was an example to all of us, an example to all of us. I was absolutely honored to have been there and join her in the goodbyes. I helped carry her coffin. I was there when they buried her. And the saddest part of it is that I was basically a week, besides the fact that she passed, it was that I was there a week and I never got a chance to at least see her, which for me would have been a little bit symbolic, because she came to visit me just a few months after she was released in 79 when I first got arrested. And she actually, after being in prison for 24 years, was willing to walk back into another one to talk to us and to give us strength and to give us advice and whatever. And so at that point, I was just beginning. That was 30 years ago. I was just beginning my sentence. And so there was kind of, you know, a sense of I wasn't able to accomplish everything, which was to give my thanks to her. And she passed, you know. So, yeah. She means a lot to the people of Puerto Rico, not just to independentistas. Everybody respected her and loved her, and she is just a symbol of honor and character and strength. Whether or not one agrees with her tactics, that's a separate matter, but she was viewed as a national heroine, and that those were the kind of statements you heard from everybody, independent of what their party flags were, you know.
Well, Carlos, I believe the same can be said for you in terms of how the country views you as a hero with high ideals.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, a lot of us here have been involved, not as direct a way as you in the struggle for Puerto Rican independence, but to see you having done 30 years and to come out still as militant and as strong is a real testament to you and to the level of struggle for an independent Puerto Rico.
Carlos Torres, you're back now. What are your plans? What are you going to be doing?
Well, my immediate plans are to try to develop a working studio. I still live in a society where I got to pay the rent. And so I want to be involved in pottery. I love pottery. And so hopefully I'll be able to make that happen. And not only for the basic economic reason, but just for spiritual reasons, because I love what I'm doing it. And actually, I learned how to do that in prison about 10 years ago. Couldn't get enough of it. So, of course, you know, I haven't stopped advocating for Puerto Rican independence. And I won't stop advocating for the release of the political prisoners until they're out. So that pretty well sums up my agenda for the next few years, you know, or hopefully in the case of the release of the prisoners.
Well, we at the National Lawyers Guild, and I'm sure the Center for Constitutional Rights and our friends and colleagues look forward to working with you in this effort. So we will be in touch.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you,
and congratulations.
To you and to Jan and to all of the people who were engaged in the struggle to free you. Congratulations to everyone.
Thank you all. You all put in your part, too. So don't be too modest. Hard for all of us.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, take care. You. Have a good day.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention the role that the Guild played in the release of the prisoners in 1999 and in Carlos Alberto Reilly. And the Guild really has been a stalwart in supporting me and my work and the work around Puerto Rico for many, many, many years. Judith Birkin went to Puerto Rico in 79 to open the Guild project. And I just want to say that the Guild is a tremendous organization, and I know I get a lot of support from the Guild personally and politically. The Guild has been really an important player in realizing the release of Carlos Alberto. And I hope it continues to be in realizing the release of those who remain.
Thank you, Jen.
Thank you, Jen.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Legal observers from the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights were arrested last week in Arizona during mass demonstrations of protesters opposing Arizona law SB 1070 and federal law 287G. What happened? Center for Constitutional Rights legal director Bill Quigley told the media, quote, "Arizona is starting to act like Mississippi in the civil rights days." Among those arrested at the actions were National Lawyers Guild officer Roxana Orell and CCR staff attorney Sunita Patel. Sunita joins us today for an update. Sunita, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Have you gotten any sleep lately, Sunita?
I've definitely been resting up lately.
You had 3 days without sleep, or 3 nights rather, right?
Yeah.
Was this your first visit as a legal observer to some of the Arizona actions?
Yes, it was actually my first time in Maricopa County ever.
Where's Maricopa County?
That is the county that Phoenix is a part of, where Maricopa County is the home of the infamous Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is known for branding the most horrible incarnation of 287G and ICE and police collaborations.
What does that mean?
Well, he is someone who implemented this agreement between the federal immigration authorities and the police office, police agencies, his law enforcement agency, in order to be able to effectuate removal orders and enforce immigration law. So he has a 287G agreement. That's the statute under which this program is authorized by Congress. And then he also has what's called a Secure Communities Program, which allows for identification of anyone who's a non-citizen through a fingerprinting system. And he has both of these programs, but at the same time, he implements what he calls the crime suppression sweeps, which is where he takes his agents as well as a volunteer posse of regular citizens that are trained in his law enforcement tactics, and they go out in the community and they sweep up anyone who they believe is committing crimes. And in general, there's a serious belief that this is targeted towards Latino immigrants in his jurisdiction.
Now, what is this, and you're going there, have to do with the Arizona law that was just, at least parts of it, held unconstitutional? Is this related? Is that why you were there? What does this whole sheriff's thing have to do with that?
It's very related. So the community there, really with the lead of an organization called Puente, has been fighting against this repressive regime of Joe Arpaio for several years, have really been holding it down there to protect the community and resist. And they decided that on the day that the Senate Bill 1070, which is the infamous legislation that Jan Brewer signed into effect, that they were going to take to the streets and protest and commit civil, risk arrest in order to show the indignation that they feel around this law and also the general conditions under which they live. Even though parts of this bill were enjoined by federal judge Susan Bolton, there were several key provisions that were not enjoined, and those were the ones that particularly impact day laborers and undocumented community members. So the community decided to continue with the protests and continue with the acts of civil disobedience in order to show that this partial victory wasn't a full victory and that they are going to continue fighting, and also to really highlight the connection between Arpaio's general reign of fear and all of his crime-fighting tactics and abuse against the immigrant community as well as those who protect the immigrant community, and to show those linkages. It was a very incredible series of events, and I was honored and proud to be there.
So let's set the scene for your arrest. I understand, because the National Lawyers Guild had also been working on sending trained legal observers there, you were a legal observer wearing the lime green hat, correct?
That's right. Myself, as well as several other National Lawyers Guild legal observers, were there in order to document and to really just observe what was happening.
Yes. And I understand Roxana Arell, who is a national officer of the Guild, was there with a video camera, and that you had a still camera.
This is correct.
And you were outside the jail/central booking area, and people had chained themselves together and put tubing over the arms, making it difficult for law enforcement to remove them.
I don't know the term for it, but there were people with piping that were chained standing, blocking the entrance to basically the garage area where people come out. What's significant about that door is that this is the door where Sheriff Arpaio has a huge sign that says, "Help us stop illegal immigration," and gives you a phone number to sign up to be a part of this posse. And the tubing had on it, stop Senate Bill 1070 and stop 287G, again, trying to make the connection between the two laws.
So this is the Arizona law, and 280, what was it?
287G, which is the 287G is the statutory provision that allows for local law enforcement agencies to implement immigration law through a memorandum of understanding with the federal government. And so there was this blockade was set up. There was also, in addition to the six individuals who were chained in, there was also the Unitarian Universalists, as well as other community members had linked arms and were sitting on the ground surrounding these individuals. The other person who was there was Salvador Reza, who's a longtime human rights activist and one of the leading opponents of Sheriff Arpaio from the community. So they were all arrested and swept, you know, taken into the holding area. Then spontaneously, another group of individuals dropped a banner and formed another blockade. And that was the point where the officers came out and arrested those individuals, but also picked out from the crowd those of us that were close by wearing the lime green hats, and it was myself and Roxana.
We've noticed a trend in mass demonstrations over the last several years where members of the independent press are plucked out of crowds for doing nothing wrong in many cases. Do you think having a camera and a video camera was in any way related to you and Roxana being arrested?
I think that it did. Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the law enforcement agencies, his law enforcement agency, is known for really targeting people who are trying to protect activists. He's gone after two of the Maricopa County supervisors who have been vocal opponents against him, and also attorneys who have tried to protect community members from unlawful arrests and sweeps. So he has a long history of really cracking down on people trying to protect the dissenters. And I think that seeing independent media and legal observers with cameras is something that his law enforcement agencies are known to try to target.
Was your camera confiscated?
It was. I did get it back, though.
Oh,
with
good.
The,
so
with
you
the
have
pictures?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about your arrest, though. How long were you detained? What were you charged with?
I was probably arrested, I want to say it was maybe around noon, and I was released the next morning about 6 a.m.
Oh, so you spent the night in their facility.
Yes, I did.
How was that?
It was, you know, it was something that I had not planned for. I wish that I had not spent the night in jail because there was so much to do. But you know, it was an eye-opening experience, and it was really an honor to be in solidarity with the rest of the protesters and go through what they went through, even though I was there as a legal observer. I was charged with the same offenses as everyone else who was arrested in front of the jail, and that was obstruction of a highway and a public thoroughfare, and also failure to obey a police officer.
Are you supposed to go back?
Yeah, we have our next court date is on August 18th.
What's supposed to happen on that date?
This is probably just an arraignment.
Arraignment? For what charges?
For these charges.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who's representing you?
There's a legal team that's been assembled. We're going to, I'm not exactly sure who's going to end up representing me and Roxana, so we'll see.
Well, aside from having to go back for your arraignment, do you have plans to go back to participate as a legal observer again?
I do. I mean, the reason that I ended up getting there was that some of the organizers from Puente, you know, who I know, called and said, we really need support. We need to understand how to set up a legal support team. We need to understand how to work with legal observers. And it was something that we went there, and Roxana and I really worked hard with the local attorneys to try to set something up. And my guess is that there's plans to do other things in the future, and I'm sure that relationship will just continue.
Part of the law was held unconstitutional. And, of course, I don't think, as you indicated, that is the end of the problem, having that unconstitutional. There's still other problems in Arizona. And then the second was the piece I read in the New York Times saying that this was the highest month in Arizona for dead people being found in the desert who were trying to get across, apparently, or whatever, 59 people, I think, and that the morgue is actually full. So there's a lot going on besides this law that was held unconstitutional or parts of it. So just some of your thoughts about that.
Well, I think that Arizona is really, you know, people there call it a war zone when it comes to immigration enforcement. and detention. I mean, it has the record, it has the highest number of deportations. You know, it's in the top three or four of immigration enforcement, like apprehensions at the site of arrest, which is very significant. And you have all these border deaths. You have a very serious effort by law enforcement agents like Sheriff Joe Arpaio to crack down on the Latino community and instill a real sense of fear in the community. And so whether it's by deportation or it's by attrition because of fear, there are people leaving the state. The community is really under siege. I think the other thing that's important to remember about Arizona is that it's also now become the site of this incredible spark of activism and this growth of an incredible immigrant rights movement that is saying, we will not wait for Congress. We will not wait to see what the government officials are going to do. We believe we have the solutions and we know our rights. So I think what I saw while I was there was the spark of an incredible people-based human rights movement that is, you know, nascent in some ways, but has a long history in struggle.
Keep up the good work, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Okay, bye-bye.
The Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU have filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration over the limits on lawyers seeking to represent suspects on the administration's kill list. Here's what this is about. The center and the ACLU want to represent the father on his son's behalf. The son, the Muslim cleric, Anwar el-Awlaki, lives in Yemen. He's an American citizen who's been accused of terrorism but hasn't received a trial. And he is on the CIA or administration kill list. The center and the ACLU want to challenge the designation of putting him on the kill list and say it's unconstitutional to do that in Yemen with the drone or whatever means they use. Unfortunately, just before the ACLU and the center were to file on the father's behalf, the administration put el-Awlaki on the designated terrorist list. What that meant is that you need a license to now represent someone who's on the kill list. Pretty remarkable, but that's what they did. So the case that was filed recently by the center and the ACLU is to compel them to grant a license to represent him, but even more, to hold the whole licensing scheme unconstitutional. To talk more about the case, we're joined by CCR staff attorney Pardis Kebriai.
Welcome, Pardis, back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Pardis, I understand last week the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU filed a lawsuit around or related to a possible assassination attempt or drone attempt on a man living in Yemen. Can you give us a little background? What's this case about and what did you file?
The case that we filed last week was a challenge to a regulatory scheme under the Department of Treasury and OFAC, which is the Office of Foreign Assets Control, that generally prohibits anyone really from engaging in any transactions with or for the benefit of people who've been designated as terrorists, essentially labeled as terrorists by the government. I can explain more about what those regulations prohibit, but basically one of the aspects of the regulations is that legal services, even pro bono legal services provided by organizations like CCR and the ACLU, are prohibited to or for the benefit of people who've been designated. And the reason this became an issue for us is because we seek to represent the father of this individual who you were talking about. The individual is Anwar el-Awlaki. He is a U.S. citizen, currently in hiding in Yemen, and he is basically the subject of an assassination order by the president and the executive branch, ordering or authorizing the CIA and special forces of the U.S. military to target and kill him. We were retained by the father in early July, and then about 2 weeks later, he was coincidentally designated as a terrorist by OFAC and the Department of Treasury. And basically, as a function of that, it made it a crime for us to go into court and challenge the government, in connection with this authorization. So we were forced to request permission, essentially, from the same government that's attempting to kill this guy, and that's what we filed last week.
Permission to represent him.
permission to provide free legal services to him.
Yes. Right. In other words, before he was a designated terrorist, we were going to represent him and go to court to try and say it was unconstitutional to put him on a target list and assassinate him, whether with a drone or otherwise. And once they made him a designated terrorist, then the regulation says you need to get permission from the same government, as you said, that wants to kill him, permission to actually represent him.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we wanted to go into court and bring a case on behalf of his father, and who is not designated. But because the provisions are so broad and they prohibit transacting with anyone who is either on the list or acting for that person's benefit, which would qualify the father, it made it illegal for us to provide the representation we wanted to provide, to bring the case we've wanted to bring. And so we had to put that case on hold to address this issue, requested a license from OFAC at the end of July. We waited a full 10 days. We told them, we described what we wanted to do, said this was urgent, obviously, because we're talking about an authorization for our client's son's death. Didn't get any response back, and then we're forced to go to court to challenge the legality of this scheme, which we think is entirely illegal and unconstitutional.
Now, Pardis, this scheme is entirely separate from provisions forbidding material support. So we've had this scheme for a few years in the Treasury Department?
The regulations that are specifically at issue are promulgated by OFAC, and they are not new. I'm not exactly sure when they were promulgated, but they were issued pursuant to a statute that goes way back from the 1970s called IEPAS, short for the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That statute basically gives the president certain powers to regulate economic transactions involving foreign countries, foreign individuals, and pursuant to that in times of national emergency. So that has been on the books since 1977, I think. And pursuant to that, President Bush issued an executive order in 2001 basically declaring a national emergency and blocking the assets of certain people, a broad category of people, whom the government, unilaterally has designated terrorists, people who they say have committed terrorist acts or pose a risk of committing terrorist acts, people acting on their behalf, people providing material support, broadly defined, or people who are otherwise associated. So it's a mass group of people who are potentially subject to this. And it was pursuant to that executive order that OFAC issued these regulations, basically to give effect to the executive order. And under the regulations, they're just very broadly worded. It basically, makes it illegal, prohibits any U.S. person. And U.S. person doesn't just mean U.S. citizen or organizations based in the United States. It could even mean the human rights organization that we're working with in Yemen for the underlying case. If they were ever to come, lawyers from that organization, if they were to come into the United States by virtue of being on U.S. territory, they could potentially be subject to criminal penalties if we didn't seek a license. So it's an extremely broad scheme. And, what we're seeking to do here is provide pro bono legal services, which, it's outrageous.
Pardis, what constitutional rights specifically did you put in your papers that this assassination attempt violate?
The case we want to bring, we've had to sort of put on hold so that we could address this OFAC issue, but what we broadly think is that there are Fifth Amendment due process rights at issue. This is a U.S. citizen who we're talking about who is being authorized for kill in a country that is thousands of miles away from any battlefield. We are not talking about the law of war. We're talking about the law of peace. And under that framework, he, like any U.S. citizen, should be entitled, if there's credible evidence against him, to be charged and tried, and if he's convicted, to then be sentenced. But to have an authorization for his death by the president pursuant to an entirely executive secret process, we're saying is completely unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment. We're also thinking about a Fourth Amendment claim as this being an unreasonable search under the language of that amendment. And then we have an international law claim as well, as this discussing this as an extrajudicial killing under international law.
What I always find remarkable, Pardis, is anybody the government wants, they can designate in some way as a international terrorist or terrorist, and then they can do whatever they want, and their argument would be that you have to go to a licensing Bureau to be able to represent that person, to challenge the designation, to challenge anything.
Right.
I find that amazing. Now, I know what you did here. You actually did apply for a license. And why don't you tell us what happened when you applied for the license?
So we applied for a license. We sent a letter to OFAC on July 23rd. We described what we wanted to do, which was represent the father of Anwar al-Awlaki, who is not himself designated. We said we're pro bono, you know, we're nonprofit human rights and civil rights organizations, wanted to provide pro bono legal services. And we said, you know, that the nature of the representation we want to provide is absolutely urgent because of what we're talking about. We didn't hear anything back from them. Waited, you know, a full 10 days, and then last week on August 3rd, we're forced essentially to file a suit in court. We filed in the D.C. District Court and basically laid out arguments for the ways we think this scheme is illegal. It goes beyond the statutory authority granted by IEPA, which I was just talking about, and is unconstitutional even if, you know, the court weren't to find that it goes beyond the statute, in terms of infringing on our First Amendment rights to represent, to provide pro bono legal representation to our client and engage in the advocacy that is part of our missions, in addition to infringing on our client's son's Fifth Amendment right to due process and to be able to go into court and challenge unconstitutional governmental conduct. So we filed the case. We shortly thereafter, the same afternoon, actually, the Department of Treasury issued, or actually the director of OFAC issued a response. Basically, I mean, it was very carefully worded, but it basically just discussed there is a broad general provision under the regulations that does permit certain legal services, pro bono legal services, does permit the provision of those services, but what we're talking about is certain services that don't fall within that general provision. So all the director of OFAC said was sort of restated a broad general provision that does provide for some pro bono legal services, but didn't address what we're talking about, and kind of broadly said, you know, we're willing to work with these organizations to provide the representation they seek to provide. Well, but it, you know, wasn't clear that we don't need a license. And our response was basically, you know, rather than issue a press release, why don't you give us our license?
Good response.
Yeah, and you know, furthermore, it's the point is that we shouldn't be required to seek permission, even if it's granted, from the same government that, you know, we're challenging.
And the other thing that strikes me is if the government can hunt this guy down to kill him, why can't they hunt him down and bring him to justice?
Exactly. And then that's one of our points, too. I mean, going to the underlying case, you know, even under the law of peace, generally, someone should be, you know, any U.S. citizen should be provided, afforded due process, which would mean, you know, bringing him into court and charging him if there's credible evidence. There are narrow circumstances where someone could be targeted and lethal force could be used short of process, but we don't think the government has made its case for why lethal force is absolutely necessary and why lethal force is the only option on the table, given that this person and others who we don't know are on these kill lists that are essentially maintained by the CIA and JSOC, which is a clandestine sort of command that's under the Defense Department. You know, these lists are maintained for months at a time. People's names are left on them for months at a time. They're not reviewed. They're only reviewed, I think, every 6 months. I mean, that really cuts against the argument that the people on those lists present such imminent threats that killing them is the only way to neutralize any concern. These are suspects. You know, all we have at this point, regardless of what you think about this guy, are allegations. He has not been convicted of anything.
Pardis, I have two questions. One is, when you say he's on a list for killing, are the means specified? Is this going to be like a drone attack? Is this going to be, you know, some little hotshot team going in there and just murdering him? What is it?
Right. What we know so far, you know, from what's happened before is that the CIA, which is, you know, one of the agencies that carries out these killings, has seemed to have primarily used drones, and that's what's been happening, you know, a lot in Pakistan. There have been reportedly, you know, over 140 drone attacks since 2004, I think, just in Pakistan alone. So we think that drones would probably be the primary way that this killing might be carried out, but it's not entirely clear. What's ironic is that under the Bush administration, there was talk and sort of planning of developing CIA hit squads who might go in and carry out targeted killings on the ground or in a more direct way. And there was when information about that plan became public last year around this time, there was a lot of outrage about the planning and outrage by Congress for not knowing about what was going on and what was being plotted and discussed by Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush. And yet, you know, the response to the same idea here, except that here it might be carried out by a drone, just has been quite muted. You know, the perception has been that it's okay for the U.S. to do it, to carry out killings with a drone, whereas, you know, the reaction when it was talk of hit squads under Bush was a lot of outrage.
Pardis, my last question, where the case is right now in terms of what's going to happen next, and then tell us where to get information.
We, right now, you know, we filed our case. We're waiting. We requested a schedule from the court for the government to respond within 48 hours to our case and then to be in court a few days after that. We're waiting to see what the impact of this response by the Treasury Department is going to be, but we hope to resolve the licensing issue quickly, and then we're prepared to move forward with the actual case, and we'll begin work on that as soon as we can. For more information about it, you can go to CCR's website at ccrjustice.org. We've got a case page up with the filings that we took to court last week and with some information about targeted killings in general, and we'll keep adding to our website. And the ACLU also has a case page up about it as well, aclu.org.
Pardis, thank you very much, and really thank you to the Center and the ACLU for beginning to get involved in this very important case.
Good work. Thank you, Pardis.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.